Hi, this is Rick Ritter from Shed 7, and you're listening to the Oasis podcast, which is the Shed 7 podcast for this week. Enjoy.
Welcome to episode 1 of the Shed 7 podcast. Okay, it's not really, it's episode 26 of the Oasis podcast, but because we've got Rick Witter on this week, yes, that's right, Rick Witter, lead singer of Shed 7, is on the Oasis podcast this week. So we've allowed ourselves to be the Shed 7 podcast for 1 week only. So I'm really excited about you guys hearing the interview with Rick Witter. Top man, really, really enjoyed speaking to him. And it was a really good, fun interview. And so exciting to have Shed 7 back with new music, new album coming later this year. Fantastic stuff. But before we get to that, let's just catch up on a few bits and pieces. Last episode was episode 25. It was the second one back from having had a bit of time off over the summer. And when I put these episodes out there, you sort of expect certain numbers of downloads. The biggest downloads I've had was on Tony McCarroll, not surprisingly. And you would think that the biggest and most successful episodes would be the musicians, the people that were connected with the Oasis story, the big names. So I was extremely surprised when the last episode dropped, which was the interview with Katie Georgiou. It was our best one-day figures I'd ever had on the podcast. Better than Brian Fallon, better than Tony McCarroll, better than Brian Garcia, Brian Cannon, any of those guys. This was... I couldn't believe it. I honestly didn't quite understand. I thought the figures must be wrong. It turns out that you guys love hearing the fan stories. I think that's what it comes down to. And I'm definitely going to try and mix it up more and just have, as we've said before on here, a mixture of fan stories, a mixture of people that were connected with the band, other musicians from the time. So we're going to keep mixing it up. And as always, if you want to get in touch, if you've got a fantastic story similar to Katie's, get in touch. And if it's good, then yeah, fine, come on and we'll do an episode. Thank you very much for everyone that's got in touch and with myself and with Katie to give really good feedback on that episode. I think a lot of people did really enjoy it and found it very moving, very interesting. So thanks again, Katie, for your time. And I'm really pleased that so many of you seem to enjoy it so much. It's been another crazy week in the world of Oasis, Liam and Noel Gallagher. It's been phenomenal, really. There's been so much going on. So the first thing that we'll get to is that we have new music from Liam Gallagher. Greedy Soul has been released as a single officially, I suppose. You don't really have single releases, I suppose, these days anymore. It's more just that it's now available on Spotify. So he went out and he did it on Later with Jules Holland live on the Tuesday. So let's have a little bit of that now.
Oh,
of cool to hear. I thought that the sound was a bit off. I think when you heard the chorus came in, I think that the backing vocals were far too loud, and there was points when the brass was a bit overpowering. So I know it's a live TV show, and it's what they try to do their best, but yeah, I think often at Jules it's not great. We'll see. So on the so that's the Tuesday live, and then on Saturday night they put out the full version of the show, which obviously they sort of can have a few more takes and try again. And I think it's going to be an extra song. The other one they did was Wall of Glass as well. So yeah, we'll see if they do another one. Maybe I'm thinking he might end up doing an Oasis song, or it would be good to hear something different, like a Paper Crown. Maybe that would be good to hear. So, but anyway, so we'll see what happens. By the time we come to the next episode, that will already be out and we'll know. So it is right around the corner now. So October the 6th is the release date. Everyone's getting very excited. I ran a poll out there on Twitter saying, which album are we most excited about? And thank you to at Mainly Oasis and at My Oasis World on Twitter, because they both retweeted that to their sort of 11,000 and 16,000 followers. Makes my 1,800 followers seem a bit paltry, but there you go. So they tweeted it out there, and yeah, I think I had almost 3,000 votes in the end, which was great. And it was quite surprising that the turnaround was 74% of you were more excited about As You Were, Liam's album, than Noel's album. Now, that's a nice transition over to the Noel news for this week, which was that we finally have got some music from Noel. Now, it didn't come as a single or a track release or anything like that, but it came as a sort of preview teaser video for the album. Crazy sort of psychedelic visuals, which was very cool. And we heard sort of three song snippets, I think. One of them in the middle was It's a Beautiful World, which to me sounded quite U2-ish, I thought. The first one has that, I played at the start, has that like alarm clock sound, and then it's got that You Got to Get Yourself Together hook, which is pretty cool. Very, very produced is the main sort of comment I'm seeing online. Very produced. You know, if you think that Liam's stuff is very sort of stripped down to vocal and think like For What It's Worth, it's very, very stripped down. There's not a huge amount going on. Whereas here, you know, you can't almost not hear Noel. I mean, this is almost like a Gorillaz or like some of David Holmes stuff, obviously, because David Holmes is the producer on there. And yeah, and so I know some people like that and they think this is great. This was the sort of out there psychedelic record that he's been threatening to make for years. I've recently posted a blog by Richard Bowes who called it that Noel has been sort of saying he's going to take a trip, but he's just been waiting in the departure lounge. You know, the Amorphous Androgynous album didn't happen. He said after Be Here Now that, you know, it was going to be a big step forward and he was going to make, you know, inspired by his work with Chemical Brothers and with Goldie, he was going to move on and do something very different. Never really happened, did it? But, you know, Standing on the Shoulder does have a couple of elements of drum beats and scratches and things in a couple of places. But other than that, it's pretty much a regular Oasis record. So, but Noel had a interesting interview on Absolute Radio where he kind of laid out the plan for the album and what it was like working with David Holmes. And that, I think, is definitely worth listening to. So let's have a bit of that.
I started this album while I was making the last one. And what happened is I'd done all these demos and I thought I'll get a producer now to kind of take it to somewhere else. And I met David Holmes, who done this album with me previously. So I called him and he came to London to listen to these tracks. And he said, yeah, they just sound finished. I come to Belfast to his studio. And in between the breaks of making Chasing Yesterday, I was going to Belfast.
Yeah.
And I said to him, well, what about the songs? And he said, don't write any songs. We'll, you know, we'll do that in the studio. I was making it up as we were going along. Going in there with nothing was something I've always shied away from, but I've got to say now I've done it, I didn't find it that hard at all.
Really?
And most of the songs started from either like a tiny riff or a drum loop or even a conversation about a different band and him saying, you should write a song like Blondie. What, you mean Hitler's Faithful Dog? And he said, no, the American, you know, punk band. And I was like, good. And I'd get to a bit where I'd be writing a song and he'd say, stop there, I've heard you do that 1,000 times, and I'll go, yeah, no, but it's amazing, isn't it? And he'd say, yeah, it's pretty good, but do something different. But it was fascinating process.
That's hard when you've had your success. It must be very hard not to go back to what's always worked.
There was bits where I was thinking, I've got all these riffs that on the songs that I'm writing. He won't know. And he knew every time when I'd be playing along, and he'd say, "Is that one of yours? Have you just written that?" And I'm like, "All right, I've just come up with that right now, this second." And he'd say, "Nah, I've heard it all before. Do something different." I was like, "Bastard."
So that's very cool. I think if David Holmes can challenge Noel, you know, and really, I think that's one of the issues we've had with Noel's a lot of his work post probably Morning Glory is that he has the he will occasionally rest on his laurels. He will occasionally think that'll do and put things out that maybe aren't at the top level of quality that we expect from him. And yeah, and so if someone's going in there and stopping him from doing that, then that's brilliant. It's what we kind of said about, it's what is often said about Paul McCartney's solo career, that he didn't have a John Lennon to sort of challenge him and say, no, that's crap, do something else, and push him forward. And yeah, and if David Holmes can do that for Noel, then fantastic. Very excited to hear that. As we said, a lot of people were quite negative on it. A lot of people felt that too overproduced, too psychedelic, couldn't hear the vocals. You know, I was hearing quite a bit of negativity on it, really. So I mean, we'll have to see what happens when we get a little bit more, where to base everything on just a tiny snippet. Yeah, but I thought the visuals looked great. And overall, it's just exciting to have him back. He is also touring. There's tour dates April, May next year. And yeah, so I hope you guys all did well and managed to get hold of those. We'll see what happens. I'm recording this on Thursday night. General sale is Friday, so I might still be going. A mate of mine is looking to book some of those, so we will see. We'll see if I make it. Yeah, and Noel has taken a stand, actually. If you remember a couple of episodes ago, I had a bit of a rant about Liam tickets, about how they will automatically go into these sort of tout sites. Noel's tickets are very expensive, but at least it doesn't appear that they're going through tout sites. They are still, he's got a specific thing where the person that bought them is named on the tickets and there needs to be ID. So it kind of stops all those tout sites from doing it, which is really good. So good on you, Noel, for doing that. However, you also remember a couple of, a few episodes ago, I played a clip of Noel talking about how football's getting too expensive these days and it's not fair. They should really make football cheaper for people. How about charging 80 quid a ticket, Noel? 50, you know, I've seen standing tickets in London, 80 quid. It's pretty brutal. I know there are some cheaper ones out there, but still, yeah, that's a bit strong, I think. But anyway, it's a market. It's going to sell out anyway, even if you charged 100 quid a ticket. You know, probably sell out a lot anyway, so there we go. So I hope you guys all managed to get tickets, and yeah, what a great time to be an Oasis fan. We get to see Liam and Noel. I saw a brilliant tweet, actually, I can't remember who said it the other day, but they said it's a bit like your parents splitting up. It's sad to see, but at least you're getting two sets of presents, and I think that's very much how we're feeling. So this time, by the next episode, it will be the As You Were will be out there, and we will be reviewing it. So in the meantime, please, once that's out there, let me know your thoughts. My favourite thing, as I've often said, is audio message. So if you can record me a little audio message on your phone, if you're on an iPhone, just go to like the voice recorder app, anything like that, WAV file, MP3 file, doesn't matter. Just fire it over to me and I should be able to work it into the show. Let me know your thoughts on it. Yeah, it'd be really good to get lots of different voices and lots of different opinions on next week's episode. So let's have a little bit of new music, shall we? This is a band called Old Town Souls, and Kevin, the lead singer and guitarist in the band, got in touch and he sent me a track and also a little introduction, so I'll leave it to Kevin to take it from here.
Hi, my name is Kevin Iverson. I'm the lead singer and guitarist in a band called Old Town Souls. We're an English-based band from South East Kent. I first heard Oasis in 94 when I was 12 years old. They were the first band that truly inspired me. With their tunes, the clothes, the attitude, there hasn't been a band like them since. It's great to be able to listen to the Oasis podcast and listen to the stories and updates on one of the world's most important bands. Thanks for having us. From the left to the right, walk goes on.
Kevin, for sending that over. I do really appreciate it. And if you want to check out more of Old Town Souls, they're on all the usual places, including SoundCloud. Just search Old Town Souls and you'll find them. Okay, and the last thing to say before we get into the episode is we did our Vinyl Soul competition. So if you remember, what we did was we said that send me and at Vinyl Soul Images the most iconic image of Oasis. And one of the first people to get in touch was Elliot Marsh, who is at Elliot Marsh on Twitter. And he sent a fantastic picture. You might recognize the picture. It's fantastic. It's of it's at Main Road. You can see Liam from behind. He's got his arms outstretched and you can see this unbelievably packed stadium. And it just looks so incredible. And Elliot did a brilliant description of it. He said, "Most iconic image, one man and all his people right there, right then at Main Road, homecoming in 1996. And yeah, it's such a great image of Oasis, and it just sums up everything that they were in 1996. So well done, Elliot. And there is a fantastic Vinyl Soul print on its way to you. Thanks to everyone that also took part in the competition. You can still get hold of one of those great Definitely Maybe prints. Head to at Vinyl Soul Images on Twitter and all over the internet to find out more about the other great prints that Matt makes. So yeah, that's fantastic. If you would like to follow in the footsteps of Vinyl Soul and also Supernova Scars from a little while ago and get involved in a competition with us, then please do get in touch. It's a great way of getting a bit more exposure. More than happy to give exposure to companies where they've got a cool product and something that the Oasis fans like. And it can just be a bit of fun on the social media stuff and get exposure for you, and all it's going to cost you is a competition prize. So do feel free to get in touch. So enough of my yakking. Let's get on to this interview with Rick Witter. I hope you really enjoy this. So after this brief musical interlude, it will be me talking over the phone with fresh off the school run Rick Witter. Hello, mate. How you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. I thought a York number might be you. There you go.
There you go, yeah. Yeah, thanks for changing your podcast name and stuff for a week. Nice to do that.
Well, it was good fun. I just thought it's funny because calling it the Oasis podcast has been brilliant because, you know, I've never said it's the official Oasis podcast, but I kind of use the logo and stuff. And so it gets me a lot of followers that if it was just called a random name, it probably wouldn't.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. You're going to draw them in with using that name, aren't you?
Yeah. But then the downside is obviously like there's loads of people that I'd love to talk to. And then I hadn't really pushed for to try and get hold of musicians myself because I thought, well, they're not going to come on the Oasis podcast, and whereas it's only really when people sort of are tagging on Twitter and sort of saying, oh yeah, you should get this guy on, and I said, yeah, great, if they want to come on, that'd be brilliant. And I do really appreciate your time, mate.
No, that's not at all.
So you just back from the school run?
Yeah, just dropped off at school, yes, and I've got kind of a busy day ahead doing a lot of this kind of thing now. Yeah. Obviously, it's been a while, so it's getting back on the horse, so to speak.
Yeah. And, well, I was going to say, it must be so exciting to have, you know, the singles out there now and kind of getting a really good buzz. And, you know, how have you found the reaction to it?
It's just gone a bit crazy, really. I mean, it's just all a little bit different to how I remember it being way back when, sense of how things are released and what things have to happen these days on a release. You know, it's a bit, I find it a little bit strange, to be honest with you, how we announce that we're doing new stuff and there's going to be a release date such and such a time, and then you find the Steve Lamacq show are getting in touch with us saying, can we have the first play, and then Sean Keaveney's wanting to play it, and then Chris Moll wants to play it, and we're thinking, oh, this is all great. But then what we realise after that is it's yet to actually go to a Radio 6 playlist meeting.
Yeah.
So they're really wanting to play it, but it still has to go to a board of people who then decide if they're going to play it on a regular basis, which is all a bit bizarre to me, really.
Yeah.
Well, the interest is there to play it. Just play it all the time.
Yeah. Well, I suppose you've got the individual DJs, especially now you've got Absolute, you've got Radio X, you've got Radio 2 is basically, and Six Music. It's all musicians now. It was something you covered in your podcast that you did with Clint Boone. But it does feel like there's so many, and yourself on the radio now as well. It's like there's so many people that are, you know, that we grew up with in the 90s, whether they were, you know, on TV or in bands and stuff, that are now mainstays on radio. And obviously they're mates with you, or they know you and they like your stuff and want to play it. It's just then if it goes to a bunch of kind of trendy people that choose not to, I don't know.
Yeah, it's a strange one, isn't it? But then, yeah, as I say, I mean, I'm not doing the radio at the minute, but because of the fact that I was doing it and because of the fact that I was in a position that I was in, it was quite good to get people in bands on and chat to them for 10 minutes live on the radio, because I think they were more comfortable doing it, because they know I'm not going to ask stupid questions.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just going to... I've been there to an extent myself.
Yeah.
So I know what would be a rubbish thing to be asked, you know. I mean, still, in the sense of, even in 2001, when we'd been going for maybe 13 years, we were still getting asked why we were called Shed 7. So, it got to the point in the mid-90s where we'd just refused to answer that question.
So my first question, Rick, why are you called Shed 7?
I knew that was coming.
No.
It's because our drummer lost his virginity when he was 7 in a shed.
Oh, nice. Classic. No, that's very nice.
Those were the type of answers that we started to just come up with randomly, just to kind of make it more interesting for us, you know.
Well, that's great. And there's things like... You know, and I suppose every kind of quirky radio idiot thinks that they're the only genius to ever come up with this stuff. But like, if you were a biscuit, what sort of biscuit would you be? And stuff like that. You think, oh,
what's your favourite colour underpants? Yeah.
No, I think that's what, you know, doing this, it's like, well, I'll always put it out there to fans and say, well, what do you want me to say? You know, because I'm, you know, we're here to kind of, you know, nominally it's the Oasis podcast, and it's nice to hear the stories of, you know, related to Oasis and then related to just the bands that were around at that time. And it's more become like a, you know, sort of a celebration of, you know, of what happened in that period, kind of, you know, throughout the 90s. And I mean the mad thing, well, getting into it, but like, you know, it just looking back and sort of over the last few days sort of looking into it, I mean, it's just bizarre, like the parallels with Oasis throughout 94 particularly, and then even throughout. It's like, you know, your debut single comes out in March 94, as does Supersonic. Yeah, and it was almost like you're sort of blow. It's like Rocky or something. You're both throwing punches at each other. You know what I mean? All throughout '94.
Yeah, it was a bizarre time for that. I mean, obviously, going back a little bit, we were all certainly me, Paul, and Tom. We were in bands together since we were kind of 13 at school. You know, obviously, looking back, slightly embarrassing listening to like home demos that we made, but we were very young and obviously we were finding our feet.
Yeah.
You know, we used to put on gigs in local pubs when we were 14 and 15. I don't know how we got away with that, but you know, we'd used to put posters up around school advertising the fact and get told off by the teachers, you can't advertise a pub gig, you know. You're basically telling loads of 14-year-olds to go to a pub. You know, so we spent an awful long time learning the tricks of the trade, really, I guess, and, yeah, and putting the effort in and just doing it because it was a fun thing to do. You know, I decided I want to sing when I'm 9 or 10 years old, and Paul decided he wanted to play the guitar when he was 11. You know, we used to go around school in first and second year telling everyone we were in a band, but we'd yet to write anything. We just loved the fact that we were in a band, you know. Yeah. We'd almost sit in each other's bedrooms creating album covers to songs we'd yet to write, you know. Yeah. Down to the point where we'd have the copyright on the back and the barcode number and what label we were on.
I love, you know, that. So, and yeah, before you'd written a song, you got into arguments of how you're going to credit the song.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we were having songwriting issues way back when. Yeah.
Musical differences before you've even written any music.
Yeah, yeah. So, but then, you know, around the time that we were becoming 18, Stone Roses come on the scene with their debut album. That was a bit of a benchmark for us, really. That was when, yeah, we started calling ourselves Shed 7 and decided to kind of up the ante a bit and take it a bit more seriously.
Yeah.
And then, obviously, very early 90s, it all starts going a little bit wrong for them. The Happy Mondays are all falling apart, and suddenly there's a bit of a rave scene going on. Mm. And what I've kind of realised, around that time, we were thinking, obviously, we're just a band from York, not a very big indie scene in York for a start. So we're thinking, right, we're going to kind of try and bring guitar music back without realising that there's a Cast in Liverpool and there's a Blue Tones down south and there's a Sleeper and there's an Oasis. And obviously that's what all came crashing together around about that time and created Britpop.
Yeah.
But I don't think any bands were kind of aware that others were doing it. And it was only when in about 93, I mean, we signed our record deal in 93, and obviously lots of other bands were doing a similar thing. So when we started getting in the top 10 Enemy best unsigned acts list and all of this business, we suddenly started seeing the name Oasis quite a lot. And as you've just said, it got to the point very early on where we were releasing stuff, they were releasing stuff, there was an awful lot of kind of gatherings. And I don't know, I can't speak for Oasis, but I get the impression that in the early days, obviously, the attitude that Oasis had, we're best, everything else is a bit inferior to us.
Yeah.
That kind of swagger going on. I do remember we kind of had a joint headline gig with Oasis at the New Cross venue in 94.
Yeah.
We turn up at the soundcheck time, they're already there. So we walk in and we're kind of almost a bit excited because we'd heard this name quite a lot. You know, oh, this is great, we're going to meet Oasis. So we enter the venue and they're all just stood in a group in the next to the stage. And immediately Liam comes up saying, you're not using your backdrop and we're going on last. All right, okay, nice to meet you, Liam. Thanks. So it's kind of, I don't know whether, obviously they went and skyrocketed and fair play, great stuff.
Yeah.
But maybe in the early days, there might have been a little bit of a threat from us.
Yeah,
which
yeah,
is why they were kind of a little bit like that.
Yeah. But you were crafting, you know, that's the thing, that those, it's funny now listening back to Change Giver. I sort of, you know, have just sort of gone back and ploughed through all your stuff and but really listened and tried to think about it. And it's like, you listen back to Change Giver now as an album, because it is, as you said, it was, there wasn't a Britpop, you know, when you guys were crafting that and recording it. And so you can hear in there, I mean, you can hear there's a very dancey edge to a few tracks that's still got that Roses, Mondays kind of dancey feel to them. Your voice has still got, you know, there's your voice definitely sort of changed over the years. You sort of a bit more expressive, maybe you're sort of growling and wailing a bit more, you know, in that, on that album, I think.
There was an awful lot of kind of, because a lot of them songs were written when we were late teens, you know, and, you know, certainly with Definitely Maybe, they had the opportunity to go back and fix things that weren't quite right, which probably cost creation a lot of money, whereas we didn't really have that option.
No.
And looking back on it, it's a good debut album, and I always put Change Giver in the in the mould, because, you know, I can't listen to it. I sound about 13 on it. It embarrasses me. I look at it upon, if you two heard their first couple of albums, I think they'd probably think a similar thing. And REM, yeah. You know, I think we're one of those bands that just needed to hone our craft over the space of time, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right, there's a few, lots of Smiths influences in there as well. Basically everything that we were kind of listening to towards the end of our school life was all spilled out onto that, you know.
Yeah. No, I think it's a great, as you said, it's a great album. Like, listening back to it, it's just, it's a funny one. Like, once again, like, talking, you know, you kind of have these way it sort of did run against Oasis, and that it's a very, you know, there's not a huge amount of additional instruments. It's basically you guys. I think there's a couple of tracks with strings, maybe, off the top of my head, but
you know, it's a brass. Yeah, basically just does.
But then, and then once you get into Maximum High, and especially Let It Ride, then it just expands out and expands, and you, and I mean, the brass is the one thing I was going to pick up on, and you know, because it's great that you guys tour with the brass section now as well.
Yeah.
I mean, what is that? Was that something in your childhood or something, or was it in the writing, or was it, you know, whose idea was that? Because it's definitely a big thing in your sound that I think really adds a lot to it.
Yeah, I think certainly with the Maximum High, Maximum High is a strange one, really, because difficult second album syndrome and all this, which we didn't really have. I mean, if you listen to most of the songs on Maximum High, it's all just really positive, you know, I think maybe we had a little bit to prove, because at this point, the press were kind of starting to, you know, categorise us as a small band from York with daft haircuts. You know, we kind of fell out of favour a little bit with a lot of journalists. I don't know why. You know, it's not like we were going around slagging off their publications.
Mm.
But yeah, I think we just wanted to just throw everything at it and make it as good as we possibly could. So obviously, all the instrumentation would have been our kind of initial idea.
Yeah.
But then we would have just seen it building and growing in the studio ourselves. We would have got a brass section down and kind of, I do remember kind of bits like in Going for Gold in the verse where it goes, did it, did it. I think that came from me. Just seeing these guys come in and get to know the song and put their stamp on it, it was just all very exciting, which funnily enough is exactly what's happening again now. It's almost like, harking back to Changegiver, your debut album, you have a few years really to kind of hone it and get it how you want it.
Yeah.
And that's exactly the position we're in now. It's almost like what we're about to release is a debut album, really.
Yeah, it feels exciting like that. It's funny, you did a DJ gig with a mate of mine who's come on the podcast, Antel. They do the What's the Story nights and in around Northampton.
All right, yeah.
And he was, he was sort of another one that said, oh, you need to get Rick on, your top man. He was great when we did those couple of nights. And he said that you were on really great form because you had sworn him to secrecy, but you told him, we're going to do new music. And I think you just heard, like, that day or something that it had come together, and so you were really excited about it. So it's sort of been percolating for a while now, but now you're...
Well, it had, yeah. I mean, obviously, we've now been reformed officially, doing tours every other Christmas for about 10 years. I think the first kind of comeback tour was in 2007, so we've almost, give or take a year or two, we've almost now been a band now longer than we were in the 90s, which is a little bit bizarre. But yeah, so obviously we reform, we're all busy doing other things. We were asked constantly since 2007 of various hardcore fans, when will you write something new? Will you ever write something new? And it just became a question that was just unavoidable to say no to, really. But the reason why we kept it on the down low is because we just didn't want to put undue pressure on ourselves. If we announced, right, we're going to go and try and write new songs, it just would have made it a little bit more difficult.
Yeah.
Simply because people would, the expectation levels and all of this. So we just thought, if we just do it on the quiet, just see what happens. If we've lost the muse, then so be it. At least no one knows that we have lost the muse. We'll just say that we're busy doing other things, you know.
Well, it's like the Roses. You know, I suppose the Roses had that, didn't they? That, so everyone's so excited about this new album, and we got two singles, one of which, you know, was pretty poor, I thought, one of which was good. And then they split up, and it's like, oh, hold on, what? Where was the album?
Yeah, it's all a bit of a shame, really, that. I think they might have even been pressured into doing that just to appease people who spent loads of money going to watch them live again.
Right.
But yeah, well, you have that for sure. I'm just guessing, really.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this is one of the reasons why. The only reason we're doing this is because we know it feels right. Yeah. You know, if we'd have just released any old guff just to kind of appease our fan base that have been there for so long, the last thing we wanted to do was piss all over our history, really, you know, just ruin the back catalogue, because there's an awful lot of good quality singles. And the exciting thing is, we're releasing a 12-track album in November, and to me, 10 of them could be singles.
Brilliant.
So it's all very exciting. But, you know, when we first decided, right, let's get together, and rather than just rehearse an old set list so that we get tight and match fit to play a gig, let's get together and just try and write a new song. And within a month of getting together, maybe once a week, we had four or five songs, and we're all looking at each other going, well, I think there is room for this.
Something, you know? No, that's good. How's the writing been? Because obviously you've got the both kind of, you had these guitarists, like one would come in, he would go, and then the other one come back in. And now you're both, I suppose,
history.
Yeah, but now you've sort of, so was that tricky then when you sort of reformed? Was it like, okay, we'll get both Paul and Joe in? I mean, was that a bit funny? I mean, sort of, you know, thinking back to the, you know, like other bands when they reform, especially when there has been changing lineups, it's very tricky to sort of say, well, who are you going to pick? You know, I suppose it's just who you haven't fallen out with, maybe.
Well, this is it. I mean, it was only fair that both guitarists were given the option of wanting to come back, and they were both very excited at the prospect of that. And this is way back in the early days of reforming. And even that, I remember we got together to rehearse and play our old songs with the aim of seeing if it would work or not. And immediately it just did. It became, because there's two guitarists, it became a little bit more Rolling Stones-y, really. A lot more kind of in your face, a lot more swagger in there. We just knew that was going to work immediately.
I know, it's great. And I think, because obviously when you've got, that's always, I suppose, the problem when you've got bands with one guitarist. I mean, often they will get like a second touring guitarist anyway and things like that, don't they? Just, and so, but there you've, it's, I suppose it's just the guys have got to sort of sit down and figure out, okay, on this track I'll do this. And yeah, so was that all right? Was there much friction, or did it work out all right?
Not really, because obviously Paul and me wrote a healthy list of songs together, and then me and Joe also wrote a lot of songs together. Dolphin was Joe's and mine, way back in the day.
Would you get blood if you had any? Would you say I'm good, or are there far too many fish in the sea? Won't you please say that again?
The song that you had more involvement in, you had a little bit more say in who should play on what and who should do what on it. So it was relatively easy in that respect.
That's good.
Certainly for me, because I've sang on all of them.
Well, and then the writing side as well. I mean, because I was, you know, I've never heard you talk about this in an interview. I mean, I'm sure you probably have hundreds of times, but because you said, you know, you don't play instruments.
Yeah.
So is that, I mean, do you literally don't play instruments? Is it like you've never even picked up a guitar and had a play with it? Because
I've certainly picked up a guitar several times, and after about 20 minutes, I'm throwing it across the room in frustration.
Really?
And like anything, the more time you put into it, the better you'll get at it. But I just don't have that kind of inclination. I'd love to be able to do it.
Yeah.
But I get to the point now where I'm just thinking I'm mid-40, and the thought of going on a stage with two other guitarists and me holding an acoustic guitar or something to blend it all together, it just wouldn't look right to me. No. I don't know why. It's just something that I've just thought over the space of time. It's when you started seeing Bono playing an acoustic guitar in a big arena along with the Edge. It just, you know,
doesn't
just stick
right
to what you do.
Doesn't
you know
look right, yeah. No. I don't think
an awful lot of melodies flying around in my head all the time, so I'll just hum it to one of them and then they'll recreate that if it's good enough, you know.
That's brilliant. So you literally, what, are you sort of now kind of recording, you know, you're just sort of singing it into your phone and little, and then sort of emailing it over to them or something?
Exactly that, yeah. I mean, if what usually would happen with, well, what's always happened when we write new songs is either Paul or Joe will come up with a guitar riff or a set of chords and present it to me, and then I'll pretty much every time the first melody that comes into my head is the one that's used. You know, if I'm struggling with something, it's put on the back burner. But usually I'll just come up with the melody immediately, and then from there I'll try and start piecing words to that melody. So, you know, we can come up with the basic bones of a song pretty quick.
Yeah.
And then dependent on the mood, even what time of day it is, can dictate how long that song's going to take to actually finish. I mean, some of them can take months, but others can take 20 minutes. And the bizarre thing there is Chasing Rainbows literally took about 20 minutes to write.
Yeah.
I could deny, but I'll never realize I've been chasing rainbows. Oh.
And there's a song on this new album called Better Days that I believe is our 2017 version of Chasing Rainbows. And again, it took 20 minutes. It's almost like you're just grasping into the air and grabbing it. It's weird.
Fantastic. Yeah, I think that comes up, all, doesn't it? Like with Yesterday, McCartney, you know, it's like he dreamed it or whatever. You know, those great moments are...
Apparently Paul McCartney he played it to loads of people saying, look, I've come up with this, but I'm sure this is actually a song already. Do you recognise it?
Yeah.
And everyone's going, no, you've done that.
Yep.
And again, Better Days, this song, I think it's one of those to me. I think it's one of those that... It's a bit like when I first heard Elbow, One Day Like This.
Yeah.
The first time I heard that, I thought, well, obviously that is a song that should exist.
Yes.
You know, it's just right. It feels right, you know.
Yeah.
And I put Better Days into that kind of category.
Fair enough. And so on the new album then, so have you got, like, I know Clint's done stuff with you in the past. Is he coming back on this album with you?
Not this time, no. We've not really had much outside influence with other musicians as such. I mean, there is a little bit of gospel singing on there. There's obviously there's strings, there's brass. There's all the Shed 7 hallmarks, basically, but with really good strong melodies and good rock and roll sounding guitars.
Cool.
I mean, Room in My House that people have now started to hear.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bit of a... We wanted to make a point of releasing something that was... I mean, it's still very Shed 7, but we just didn't want to release a really traditional Shed 7 song first, because the story this time is it's been 16 years since the last album. So that story will immediately evaporate as soon as the album's out, and then from then on we're just a working unit again. So we just wanted to kind of come back. We didn't want people to go, oh yeah, they're back and it sounds very Shed 7, you know what I mean? But there is two or three songs on there that if you are a massive Shed 7 fan, you're going to be very, very happy, because it is very Shed 7.
Well, I love it. So straight away it kicks in with that, like,
oh,
you know, it's like, oh, wow, okay. And I was thinking, I haven't heard that in a Shed 7 before. You know, I haven't heard, I don't think that's something you've done. You know, you've got that, like, that sort of pounding all the way through, which is really cool.
Yeah.
And then I really
That's why I would show that song, because it is slightly, a slight curveball in the sense of, yeah, we've never done that before.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's funny because that song went to Radio 2 and they've said it's a slightly too rocky sound for Radio 2, the Radio 2 audience. But then we've shown them the next single, which has got Radio 2 written all over it, and I think they're quite excited to play that.
Oh, good.
So, so fingers crossed, they will.
But no, I really like it when it comes back into that...
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, find me not guilty.
Like, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, that
yes.
I think that's great, because then it's just sort of, it just shifts a little bit, you know what I mean? And it's got the, and then the guitars reminded me of sort of John Squire, but like kind of Second Coming sort of John Squire.
Very Love Spreads, and also a little bit Whole Lot of Love, you know.
Yeah.
It's just got a big sound to it.
Yeah,
and to me, it's like three songs in one, that song.
Yeah. No, I think it's one of the tracks of the year for me. From, you know, I mean, we're very lucky. It's funny, we were sort of having some fun and games on Twitter last night, and I've sort of, you know, it's mad whether it's because it's 20 years or whatever it is, but it just feels like this. There is a resurgence in these bands that were, you know, great in the 90s and you know, carried on, and you know, whether the people that have carried on or the people that have sort of reformed. I mean, it's amazing, and I think it just goes that there's, you know, looking back now, we're 20 years on from it, and you sort of going, yeah, these bands were bloody great, you know, and there's, you know, and there's, and when you sort of look on, you go like, okay, well, in the, you know, just in that last 20 years since then, it's like, yeah, there's been good bands and there's been stuff that's come along, but there hasn't, I mean, and I don't, you know, I sort of have to kind of stop myself all the time and say, no, is it just because I'm old? Yeah, is it just because I'm like, that was what meant so much to me when I was in my teens? But actually, no, there's plenty of followers on Twitter who are saying all the time, I'm 17, I'm gutted, I wish I'd been there 20 years ago. You know, and what do you think?
The 90s has become a bit like what people used to say about the 1960s, isn't it? You know, it's like a mass. I mean, to be honest, I don't think, I think technology has a lot to answer for in the respect of, I can't really see there ever being a big communal music scene again, you know, because it's so easy these days just to click a button and get what you want, you know. It just makes you wonder if there'll ever be a news piece, News at 10, saying who's going to get to number one, this guitar band or this guitar band, you know.
Well, only if Noel and Liam switch their albums to come out on the same day.
Well, that's very true.
That might do
very
it.
True.
But no, it's I was going to say, so it sounds like, you know, from that, I don't want to cover loads of ground that you covered already with Clint Boone on that podcast. And anyone that's, you know, out there, go out and listen to that, because that is a really good piece. But so you're sounds like you're very good mates with Clint. And is there any other sort of musicians from the other bands? I think Rev from Reverend of the Makers is a mate of yours, is that?
Yes, and John Power, obviously they're going to be supporting us at Christmas, so that should be... That should be a good 6 weeks of fun, hopefully. Well, it's funny because I bump into... Well, we're in York, so you don't really bump into people that much. But when we're out and about these days, it just seems a little bit different. I think maybe everyone's just grown up a bit. Because in the 90s, there was maybe a little bit of that competition of, you know, who's going to do better than who this week. And, you know, there'd be times at festivals where, perhaps looking back... We're all just humans, and just you know, we should just kind of get together and make it a fun experience.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was times, I don't know whether maybe Oasis had a bit of blame for that, right? Really, by just creating animosity and stuff. But I think that's just the type of people they are, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh yeah, they're just they would deliberately try and do it. But you know, as we've said, I mean, everyone that comes on that meets Liam, like, well, any fan I suppose that meets Liam in the flesh just always says, you know, loveliest bloke you could ever meet. But I suppose they're not a threat to him. you know.
Yeah. Which I'm kind of hoping that isn't the case anyway now, you know. Mm-hmm. We're going to release an album. He's just about to release an album, and it doesn't matter to me. It's just music. As long as people put it on the stereos,
yeah,
and just sing along and love it for what it is, it doesn't really matter. There's no competition for me at all, you know.
No, it's cool. One of the things I was just going to say is that it's amazing how, I mean, so on the podcast on Twitter, we did a thing a couple of months ago where we did like a 30-day Britpop challenge, and so every day I was just getting people to nominate, you know, what's your favorite Britpop song for, you know, going for a walk, or, you know, going on a date, yeah, or what, you know, all those things. And I'd say Shed 7, obviously it's the Oasis podcast, so people, you know, Oasis came up the most, but
yeah,
I'd say Shed 7 were probably second. You know, it's
right.
It's unbelievable, you know, and to me, I mean, I don't want to be rude to say it's unbelievable, but, you know, I always thought of you guys as, yeah, you are one of the great, you know, really, really good Britpop bands. But it just feels like over the years, and I was just trying to think about this, I mean, especially it was Disco Down and Getting Better and Bully Boy and things like that would just come up over and over again, that they meant so much to people. And, you know, and it's just, I couldn't quite put my finger on why it is, but I mean, have you got any idea, you know, think, and looking at the fact that now you guys, you know, Cast are supporting you, In Spiral Carpets are supporting you, you know, it's sort of, yeah, why is that, you know, how's that happened that you've, over history, you guys have sort of had this huge leap upwards, you know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, and I think the only thing I can really think of is the songs that we wrote then have just stood the test of time. It's as simple as that, really. I think,
yeah,
you know, I've said this a few times, in the 90s, we were just caught up in doing stuff. So yeah, we were, you know, oh, you've got to start writing the next album and you've got to get to Spain tomorrow to do this festival. It was just, it became job-like almost, because mm-hmm, you're just there doing it. You're a commodity and you need to be there and doing this now. So way back when, we didn't really have any time to stop and think. We were just doing it.
Mm.
And I think having that kind of four-year period where we didn't do anything at all,
yeah,
I think that really helped us as a band, because it just let the songs mature. And then, you know, when we reformed in 2007, we had no idea how it was going to go. You know, we had the idea of getting both guitarists back in. Just the plan was to play four big gigs, or four gigs of what we thought the promoter would, the size of gig that the promoter thought we could do. So we had every intention of just doing four gigs at Christmas, and then ridiculously just loads of people bought tickets, we had to upgrade the venues, and we ended up doing like a 20-day tour or something ridiculous. So, you know, and then when we eventually started playing these gigs, everyone was singing every word back, and it was like, wow, this is, you know, obviously what we did in the 90s actually meant something to people. Because at the time, as I say, we were just doing it, you know.
Yeah.
So it's very satisfying now. We have happy problems in the sense that if we play an hour festival set, what do we drop? You know, that's a real happy problem to have, you know.
Yeah, and especially now if you're going to have to be playing new stuff as well, it's like, well, you know, how many of the, what was it, 15 top 40 singles? You know, like, you're going to have to be dropping a few more of them.
Yeah, well, this is it. I mean, for this particular tour that we're about to go on, we've made a conscious decision to not play too many new songs, even though the album would have just come out, simply because we put this tour on sale probably in March, and a lot of people who've bought tickets,
right,
they know Shedsember now. They know that that's, they know what they're getting, you know, and we don't want to just suddenly come back and go, right, we're going to play 12 new songs that you don't know very well and three old songs.
Yeah.
I think that wouldn't really work in our favour. So this particular tour, there'll be maybe three or four new ones, and then everything changes, because in the past we'd do a big tour and then maybe do a few festivals the year after,
yeah,
and then book in another tour for the year after that. But this time, because we've got new material, next year is like the start of an all-new band, really, in the sense that we'll probably tour the world, we'll probably do a lot more festivals than what we would do.
Mm.
I mean, that's the plan anyway. And also start writing new songs. So it is like an ongoing new thing, really.
Wow. And how does Mrs. Witter feel about that? You like, see you later, you're doing the school run, love. Off I go.
She's probably our number one fan.
Okay.
So she'll be excited to be part of the process, probably.
Yeah, Yeah, no, that's good. I mean, it's in all seriousness, though, I mean, it's if you've been, you know, it's the reality of life, isn't it? When you're sort of single and 19 or whatever, it's fine to go off and tour the world. But it is the just that bit trickier when you've got all these commitments and you've been around to help out with that stuff for years.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. So, but the good thing is that, I mean, certainly the kids are all getting a lot older now.
Yeah.
So they can mostly look after themselves.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, obviously, if you're put in a position, because again, you know, when we decided to write new songs, again, we didn't really know what to expect. We didn't know what was going to happen. But then we started to write, as I said, by the time we'd written five new songs, we're looking at each other thinking, hold on, there's legs for this here.
Mm-hmm.
But then even at that point, we were still thinking, right, well, I'll tell you what, we'll record them to the best of our ability. You know, we'll release it. We'll just put it on iTunes ourselves, just solely for the people who we think deserve it, all of the fans who've come over the years and who love Shed 7. It's a nice present for them.
Yeah.
It's something nice for us to do. But then suddenly management hear some demos and decide that they want to manage us, which is great. That takes the pressure off slightly. But then suddenly BMG are wanting to release it. So it becomes a big working unit. And to answer your question, last year, if I was given the two options, you'd be daft not to take the best option, really, wouldn't
you? Sure,
you
know, no, absolutely.
You never know how long you're going to be around for. You never know what's going to happen next. You never know what's around the corner. So if you don't try these things, then you're an idiot, really.
Mm. No, it's you know, I suppose you're lucky that you're all... you know, you're all around, no one's died, you know, which, you know, not the case for a lot of bands. And then, you know, and you've still got your hair, Rick, you're still slim, you can still do your, you know, that's, I was watching, you know, it's tricky if people, you know, and I know it's kind of, might seem a silly point, but, you know, I was watching, on YouTube, there's like your Tea in the Park from a couple of years ago is on there.
Yeah.
You've still got the old Rick Witter, you know, hip jiggle going on, you know, even though you're a few years older, you know.
And I think that's half of the reason why we still attract quite a big crowd to our gigs, just to hear old songs,
yeah.
You know, because I think we do put on a good show, and I think that's really important. I think if we suddenly started just coming on and looking like we're not really that bothered and just stood there looking a bit bored, then that's the time to give up.
Yeah.
And I think that is exactly why people still come. And, you know, we can put a tour on sale in March and we're not doing it till December. And still even now I'll do interviews with people and the interviewer will be going, oh, yeah, my boyfriend's got six tickets in April. He can't wait. It's like a lad's night out at Christmas and it's months away, you know. So by the time we're actually in that building doing that gig, the excitement levels have gone through the roof. It's like having a massive 24-day party.
Yeah.
Which granted can take its toll when you're mid-40s.
But it's funny, I mean, I interviewed Tom Hingley from you know, lead singer in Spiral Carpets, and he's done it the different way. He basically is just tours non-stop, you know, he does sort of 150 gigs a year or whatever. And so obviously you're going to end up doing smaller venues because
that's it.
You've got that choice. You've got that, you can just keep going and doing it and taking every gig and getting out there to as many people as possible, or like you guys do, which is actually the similar model to what the Pogues have done for years, isn't it? Especially because it's a Christmas tour. So it's like, so that people can, look forward to it and get ready for it. Because, I suppose if you're, and that's sort of, it's meant that you've been able to make them. And it's almost going back full circle to what you were saying about in the very early days when you would, like Inspired by the Roses, put on events, you know, so you'd only
exactly
do one gig every 6 months or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's much better to, and again, when we were kind of starting to get a bit of a name for ourselves, we were never booked into a gig that was perhaps slightly too big for us, because it's much better to play to a sold-out crowd with people not being able to get in, because all that does is make the people who can't get in get there quicker the next time, and then obviously you start to play bigger venues. And, you know, that's why, again, we've always been quite canny. That's exactly the reason why we didn't do a kind of Shedcember tour every Christmas, because we were totally not deluded. We know that perhaps if we were to do it every year, then some people might go, oh, well, they do it every year, so I'll go next year instead. Yeah. And then suddenly you are playing slightly smaller venues, and then it doesn't look as big, you know, and you're going to be quite savvy with these things, really.
Mm.
And I think to an extent that did happen a bit with the Pogues, because they did do it every year. And then, you know, one year they'd be playing the Academy in Leeds, the next year they'd be playing the Town and Country Club in Leeds, which is slightly smaller. And it's a case in point, really.
Mm. No, fair enough. Well, like, the other thing, just to touch on the other cool things that you do. So, you know, you've been doing this radio presenting gig on radio up in York, which is good fun. It's good fun to be on that. Well, you touched upon it earlier, but yeah, nice to be on the sort of the other side of the microphone and getting to hear from people, you know, getting to hear from fans, I suppose, or like, so, you know, so regularly that you've got this slot and people are going to get in touch. And that's been good fun.
I really enjoyed doing that. I don't do it anymore. I've not done it for getting for a year now, but I did enjoy just, do you know, the reason why when the kind of approach, I'm saying, are you interested in doing something like this? The first thing that I said was, because it's a local radio station, but obviously in this day and age, you can hear it online all over the country or indeed the world. But my first question was, I'll only do it if I can play what I want to play, because every other DJ on that particular station had to play what they were told to play, you know. So it was my kind of indie show, really. And obviously, apart from playing songs with massive swear words in, which did seep through every now and again by accident, that was the biggest buzz for me, just thinking, right, what am I going to play next? I'll put a Pixies B-side on, you know, that was the biggest thrill for me.
And then even
more so when people are tweeting in saying, oh, I haven't heard this song for ages, this is brilliant. You know, it just gives you a bit of a buzz just sharing music, really.
Well, it's good that you're a fan, you know, like, because, you know, everyone that gets into music is because they're fans, and yet, you know, a lot of people, when they get some success, they kind of want to step away and be a bit too cool for school. You know, one of the other guys I interviewed was Brian Fallon, who's the lead singer of Gaslight Anthem, and, you know, huge star, you know, especially in the States, and, you know, like the heir to Springsteen in a lot of ways. And yet he wanted to come on because he was saying, oh, yeah, I love Noel Gallagher, and I'll just, like, look at pictures of him and try and find out what he's wearing and things like that. You know, he's a proper fanboy, you know, and I think that's really nice. I've heard a few of your shows, and it's, you know, you have a real true love and passion for music. And that's great.
There's no point in doing it otherwise, really.
And so what about podcasting? I don't want to get more competition, but have you ever thought about doing something like that? Obviously, Clint's has gone well.
Yeah, it's not something I've really given that much thought to be honest. I'd need to start doing a bit of research about it all. But, I mean, maybe when things kind of start calming down with the sheds again, I'll maybe give that a bit of thought. But right now, this minute, my mind's elsewhere. But certainly in this day and age, there's loads of different ways of spreading the word musically, isn't it? Not just for Shed 7, but for what I like. And you know, the thing that gave me quite a big buzz when I was doing the radio was kind of, you know, I'd just browse on YouTube for hours and be suggested to go and listen to this band if you like what you're listening to now.
Yeah.
And it was a great way of finding new music. And the biggest buzz to me was when I heard something that I thought was fantastic, even if it was a new band that no one's heard of.
Mm.
I just couldn't wait for Sunday night to go and play it.
Listen
to this. You know, listen to this. This is great.
Well, I read an interview with you from a year or so ago where you just heard the Lemon Twigs for the first time.
Yes,
and they're a great band. That is a hell of an album, that one.
Yes.
When my strength is tested, I could taste life.
again, as soon as I heard that, I thought, well, this is something a bit different. This is something quite cool.
Mm.
So, yeah, for that massive case in point, I'm imagining when I heard that on a Monday afternoon, thinking, like, next Sunday, that's straight on.
No. Little note on your phone, is it? Like,
yeah.
Cool. And what about, have you ever considered writing a book?
Yeah, that's come up in conversation a few times. The best idea for a book for us, which we've kind of, we should copyright really before someone nicks it, but we're a band who we all like opinions, and we all like to think that we're all right in our opinion. So I'm not kidding, some of our email threads are ridiculous. It can start off with basically one of us saying, what time are we going to be rehearsing next Wednesday? And that can end up with about 45 emails, with the 45th one with somebody saying fuck off to somebody else. So I've had this idea of making a book and calling it Thread 7 and just having loads of our email threads in chapters. That'd be quite cool.
That'd be brilliant. Right, you heard it here first. Publishers, get on it. No, that's fantastic. Good. And just to sort of touch on the Oasis side again. So what's your, I mean, looking back at them versus like the other bands of your contemporaries at the time, I mean, what do you think it was that made them have that big push over the top versus, you know, other bands that were probably more better musicians like Ocean Colour Scene, or, you know, better lyric writers like Damon, or, you know, what is it like? And do you think it was right that they kind of ended up being the flag bearers?
Well, they were a breath of fresh air, I suppose, at the time.
Yeah.
But the big key word here is controversy, I think. That's, you know, if they're going to have scraps, if they're going to get into trouble, it's rock and roll, it's going to get written about, they're going to get more front covers. It's just part of the game, I guess. And I think they were brave enough to just crack on and do it, you know.
Mm.
I mean, perhaps we were guilty of not playing ball in that respect as much as perhaps we should have done. But to be honest, it would tire me out, you know. It does make me wonder sometimes when these singers in bands who are constantly just on and have got the swagger, it makes you wonder whether they go home and sit down with the girlfriends or the wives and go, oh, that was a hard day.
I know
you know what I mean, it'd tire me out.
And so what about what about music wise? I mean, what do you look back on from the 90s and think, you know, like people would pick on like maybe Shaq or like, you know, Paulo Hewitt would pick out Shaq as his band of the 90s. Is there when you look back at those bands, which ones jump out as like that was the best album or that those were the best bands?
Well, there's a band who aren't going anymore called The Soundtrack of Our Lives.
Their biggest album
was, I think that was at the beginning of the noughties, but they did have an album in about 98, their debut album, I think it was, which was fantastic. And that was something, to me, that was kind of slightly different, but very cool, you know. My only problem with that album is there's about 24 songs on it, and if they just shaved a few off and made it into more of like a 14-track album, every one of them would have been a winner.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, they were a great band. I mean, just loads of good music, and then a lot of chaff as well. But that's just the nature of music, really, isn't it? You know, you're always going to get bands who kind of are into other bands and want to recreate that sound almost, but put their own stamp on it. And sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't.
And I tell you what, when I heard the Arctic Monkeys for the first time, I thought, oh, this is like a new Shed 7. Right. Because firstly, there's that singing in the, you know, you always, you know, I commend the fact you didn't move to London. You know, you guys stayed in York, which, you know, maybe once again, maybe that's why another reason why you didn't, you know, the Gallagher brothers, obviously straight away, first sniff of success and they'd moved to Belsize Park. But was it important for you to stay in York?
Yeah, massively so. I think, you know, it was always good fun going to London for whatever reason. We might be there for 3 months writing and recording. We might have been there for 2 days doing interviews. But it was always good fun going and having a bit of a party. But it was also just as good to get on a train that only takes 2 hours and then you're back at home, you know. And we've always had that mentality of sticking close with your friends and stuff and being around family. So it was always, at the height of our, you know, maybe 96, 97, it was as much of a buzz coming home and meeting up with friends, and they would ask, you know, how was it, what did you do, what happened there, tell them stories about what's happened. But then they would start telling you about their lives and their jobs, which was just as interesting to me. So, you know, it just kind of almost brings you a little bit back down and makes you realise that life isn't all one big rock and roll party, which of course it isn't.
No. And that's, I think that as well, that's probably a reason why, you know, a lot of bands, their second, third albums end up being, you know, it's just them moaning about being on tour or moaning about journalists and things. And, you know, whereas
that happens so much, doesn't it? You come out with a debut album that you've had a long time to hone and put your stamp on it, and it's all about the life that you're in, and that's more understandable for the general public, because a lot of them will be in a similar situation. But then not everybody gets to go on the front of an aeroplane and be given caviar and champagne every day. and it's funny, as you say, how people write songs on the third album like that, and then they're almost moaning about it.
Whereas you've got, you know, whereas with you guys, it always felt like, you know, with your lyrics as well. That's the reason I said about Arctic Monkeys, is that, you know, you've got little, I love, there's little rhyming couplets where you'll say like, you know, she smokes cigarettes but hates the smell.
She used to smoke her cigarettes but she didn't like the smell. Now she's into knickerettes and she's putting me through hell. It's not enough to get.
And, you know,
putting me through hell.
Yeah, exactly. Nicorette's putting me through hell. And you just think, that's brilliant. You know, and anyone that's dealt with a sort of smoker giving up knows exactly what you're coming from. And it's that, you know, you've had that. And so hence when the Arctic Monkeys came along, I'm hearing a Yorkshire accent and these witty little couplets. Now, maybe I don't think that you get the credit that you deserve as a lyricist, actually, as a writer.
Well, that's very kind of you to say, and I agree with you.
There you go. That's that Gallagher arrogance that you should have shown a bit more in the 90s, mate.
Back. It's coming back.
Fair enough. Well, I'll tell you what, Rook. The only thing I was going to say, and I'll let you go, is I think, you know, going back to, like, the fact that, you know, you do seem, you know, you do seem like genuine people, and maybe that's why that people are still, you know, love to come out and see you and support you as people. And another way that you do that is that you do these handwritten lyrics for people.
Yes.
That's brilliant. And do you want to just tell us about that?
Well, I just had the idea, funnily enough, it was someone who's a bit of a fan of Shed 7, got in touch with me asking if I do these things, because she had a friend who was going to Australia and she wanted to give her like a going away present. And it's not something I'd ever really thought of, to be honest. And did it for her, and the reaction that her mate had off it made me think, well, hold on, there's more than one person in the world. So I just thought I'd just advertise if people were interested. And I think people, it's quite nice knowing that people have got a nice bit of embossed card put into a frame and put it on the wall in the house. Because the good thing here is, if I do one of these, in this day and age with Twitter and Facebook, people are taking photographs of it and sending it back to me to say thanks for doing it.
Yes.
And it looks great. Here it is on the wall. So the aim is to get every household in the country with one of them on the wall.
No, it's great. And, you know, because you handwrite them and then you've got your little, you know, message, you know, if it's a wedding or whatever it is, you write the little message.
Yeah, whatever
message
anyone would want, as long as I've written the lyrics to it, which is pretty much the majority of Shed Seven songs, then yeah.
Can you
do
a
nice little gesture?
Can you do me the words to Stay Young by Oasis, mate?
Have to have a word with Noel first.
Yeah, copyright might be tricky. Cool. Yeah. Rick, well, thank you so much, mate. I'll let you crack on, but I'm sure you've...
Thank you, James. Busy. That's nice talking to you.
Sorry, what track did you want? Is there a particular Shed 7 track or something by someone else even that you wanted to play out with that you're particularly proud of?
Well, I guess I was thinking this the day when I read your email. Maybe just... If you just play High Hopes and just explain that it was the single that never was, it shouldn't be a single that record company put the kibosh on that. But it is one of our most loved live songs, and you know, for people to hear it.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. Right, we'll play out with a bit of High Hopes. But Rick, thank you so much, mate. I'll great to speak to you, and we'll all the best.
Good man, James. Thank you for that.
Cheers, mate. Bye.
Nice one. Bye.
So kind of him to spare his time, and make sure you get hold of their new single, which is Room in My House, and the new album Instant Pleasures is out in November. So thank you for listening to the Oasis podcast, and special thanks as always go to our patrons Casey, David, Fraser, Mike and Dana. You can become a patron and support the show at patreon.com/oasispod, which is where I post articles by myself and the wonderful contributors Richard and Kyle, plus support at $3 per month or above qualifies you for your own bespoke song. We're also doing other rewards as well, such as pieces of merchandise, and also I did send over the unedited Rick Witter interview to a couple of the patrons who said that they would like that. So I'm more than happy to do bits and pieces like that for patrons, even for as low as a dollar a month. Do follow me if you're not on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook, just at Oasis Podcast. Please get in touch on email at oasispod@gmail.com. You can get t-shirts from TeePublic, and please subscribe and review on iTunes. That's my favourite way for people to get in touch. So please review on iTunes, and if you do it and I can find it, I will read it out on the podcast. So until next time, as ever, stay in touch, stay engaged, stay young.